You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders, past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty. This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. until 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Clap your hands.
Good morning, and you're listening to 3CR Breakfast on Tuesday, 30th of September 2025. And we want to say thanks to the Radioactive Show, 3CR's national program on nuclear peace and energy issues. And in the studio today, we've got a really full house. We've got Fung, Elena and Fiza. So hey. Welcome, everyone.
This is exciting.
It is exciting.
Good to be back.
Although, you know, not that it's been
not exciting.
Yes. I feel like Julia and I've had some great chats and some good shows, but it does feel a bit special to have a full house today.
It does. Yeah. I want to know something interesting that happened on everyone's long weekend. I know that Elena, you've been pretty busy.
Yeah, I just performed in Manifest, which is a dance show created by the Legacy & Co, and that was good. Spent all week at the theater rehearsing and then did three shows on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
How did it go?
That's amazing.
Well, I think by closing night, there were lots of tears. But yeah, everything went really smoothly. We had long days, but it allowed everyone in the company to get really close, especially like in our separate dressing rooms, or like six of us per dressing room. And so we definitely got to know each other pretty well.
Do you have any of the post-show blues?
I do a little bit. It's weird to not be, like, training anymore. I'm used to every Sunday being there for at least 4 hours. And this most recent Sunday, I had nowhere to be. And I was like, wow.
What do you do with your day?
Yeah, I have my Sundays back. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah. And how was your trip?
Yeah, it was really good. Went out of town for a few days, which was nice. And yeah, just tried my best to relax and rest, which isn't always very easy. I still did do a bit of work, but, you know, as a teacher, your work never ends.
I was going to say.
Yeah, but at least I tried. So that's
the
something.
Main thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What about you, Fraser? Have you had a chance to relax?
No. Relax. Yes. I'm always trying to relax. Yeah. Successfully or not. But I actually had like a really chill time because the weather was so nice over the weekend as well. So I was actually enjoying being out in the sun, had lunch, you know, in the courtyard and stuff like that of Retreat Hotel in Brunswick. Oh. Shout out. Great live music. Yeah, so that was nice, just trying to catch up with friends. And, like, yeah, I think the long weekend is basically when everybody finally, like, okay, we finally have time in our calendars to kind of, like, actually meet up and sit and have lunch and chill. So
yeah,
that was
that's
cool.
True.
Yeah, how about you?
Yeah, no, I had a good long weekend. It's my first one since I started working full-time.
Oh, yeah.
So I feel like I was like, oh, my God, a break from work, finally. But, yeah, Fung gave me some good advice last week and told me not to go to the campsite that I'd booked. And then I found a different one.
Oh, so nice. And you had a good time camping?
I had a very good time. Yeah.
Awesome.
So
awesome.
I think we made the right choice. Went to a very cozy campsite instead of a probably very hectic one. But I think we've got quite a busy show ahead.
Yeah, so we're starting the show this week by replaying a conversation that I had 2 years ago now no, 3 years ago. Oh my gosh. With Dr. Susie Allinson and Lizzie O'Shea, who came on the show to speak about their book that they wrote called Empowering Women from Murder and Misogyny to High Court Victory. And in this conversation, we talk about that book, as well as Roe v. Wade, because that was around the time that it had been overturned in the US, as well as access to abortions in the Australian context. And the reason why we're replaying that conversation today is because a couple of days ago, September 28th, was the International Safe Abortion Day. So that's coming up first.
Excellent. And at 7:30, we'll be having Sophie Rudolph. She'll be speaking about the Anti-Palestinian Racism Report, which was obviously just launched on Friday. It was a great panel. There was a teacher, a student, a parent, and it really showed how this anti-Palestinian racism permeates pretty much every level and impacts on so many bodies. And yeah, Dr. Sophie is a senior research fellow at the Faculty of Education at the University of Melbourne, researching the educational impacts of settler colonialism and engaging with various community efforts towards transforming systems of oppression. So really looking forward to that.
That will be a great conversation. At 7:45, we'll be joined in the studio by B. Regular listeners will know that B leads the Asian Migrant Project at Vixen. And the last time they were on the show, we spoke about the raids, the ongoing raids by Australian Border Force targeting Asian migrant sex workers. We'll be continuing that conversation today, as well as the fundraising event for Rising Red Lantern, which is a new initiative by Vixen to support Asian migrant sex workers in so-called Victoria.
And then at 8 o'clock, we're going to be chatting to Penny Carr from the National Association of Renters Organisation about their recent national report card into renting, which evaluated how well National Cabinet's so-called better deal for renters is going. And we'll talk about the challenges remaining across the country.
And then finally at 8:15, we'll be joined again by Lucinda Thorpe, who is privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch. And Lucinda will be speaking to us about the Privacy Commissioner's recent landmark decision regarding Kmart's use of facial recognition technology and the impacts that this sort of surveillance tech continues to have on our privacy.
And before we get into the show, we're going to do our news headlines.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty-gritty. Let's get right down to the real nitty-gritty now. One, two, nitty-gritty now, yeah, boom. Nitty-gritty, hoo-wee.
These are the news headlines for Tuesday, 30th of September, 2025. Darumbal and South Sea Islander activist and journalist Dr. Amy McQuire has taken out the $30,000 Queensland Premier's Award for a work of state significance for her book Black Witness at the 2025 Queensland Literary Awards. Dr. McQuire said she was honoured to see the book recognised in Queensland given its themes. I was really humbled and honoured that Black Witness has been recognised, particularly in the state of Queensland, because a lot of the book critiques the violence of Queensland and specifically the violence of mainstream and imperial media. Dr. McQuire noted the work is about how Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people should be believed when telling their stories and how mainstream media often falls short with truth-telling. Other Indigenous writers were also recognised at the awards. Wiradjuri writer and filmmaker E.M. Krismani won the David Unaipon Award for an emerging Aboriginal and or Torres Strait Islander writer for Finding Billy Brown, while Guri and Lebanese writer Michaela Saunders received a Queensland Writers Fellowship for her project Dear Uncle. Claire writes Naku Daruk, The Bulk Petitions, How the People of Yirrkala Changed the Cause of Australian Democracy, won the University of Queensland Non-Fiction Book Award. In other news this week, hundreds of young protesters have taken to the streets across Morocco in what has been described as some of the country's largest anti-government demonstrations in years, seeking better government services as well as an end to corruption. Demonstrators have demanded urgent investment in public health and education and denounced what they see as misplaced national priorities. The protests, organized by a grassroots movement calling itself Gen Z 212, spread to at least 11 cities, including Casablanca, Rabat, Marrakech, and Agadir.
Authorities moved quickly to contain the demonstrations, while police saying nearly 200 people were arrested since Saturday. Footage shared across on the Gen Z 212 Facebook account appeared to show police charging into crowds, seizing demonstrators and forcing a young woman into the back of a van. Systemic violence has been used against a group of young people who are demonstrating peacefully, reported Hakim Sikuk of the Moroccan Association for Human Rights. Analysts say the protests are in response to years of neglect in public services and urgent reforms in the education and health sectors. Earlier this month, the deaths of 8 pregnant women at a public hospital prompted widespread outrage. Also in the news, diplomatic sources are reporting that Hamas negotiation team will study the proposal presented by President Donald Trump just a short while ago. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he had agreed to the plan in a press briefing with Trump at the White House. Netanyahu also apologized to Qatar for the killing of its citizens in the attack on the capital Doha earlier this month. The plan proposed by Trump has been critiqued as ambitious but highly complex. It aims to reshape Gaza's governance, security, and economy. People believe the plan is an American attempt to control Gaza, especially with the deployment of a foreign stabilization force that sounds politically and logistically difficult to implement. Many Palestinians believe that the current demands regarding the demilitarization and removal of Hamas might be rejected, as it might be understood as a surrender. But things are still up in the air, as Hamas has not so far delivered its response to these terms. At least 33 Palestinians have been killed and many wounded in Israeli attacks across Gaza today. Israel's war on Gaza has killed at least 66,055 people and wounded 168,346 people since October 2023. Thousands more are believed to be buried under the rubble. A total of 1,139 people were killed in Israel during October 7 attacks and about 200 were taken captive.
In other news, last week in Egypt, political prisoner Alaa Abdel Fattah was pardoned by President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi after 6 years of imprisonment. Alaa Abdel Fattah, an Egyptian-British activist and writer, was a prominent activist and critic of the government starting during the 2011 Egyptian Revolution. He was arrested back in September 2019 during a concerted crackdown on protests by the Egyptian government. Alaa Abdel Fattah was sentenced to 5 years of imprisonment in 2021 on the charge of spreading falsified news related to a social media post, yet was arbitrarily detained past the end of his sentence in September 2024. The Egyptian government stated that he would not be released until early 2027 in violation of national and international law. Alaa Abdel Fattah was considered by many human rights organizations to have been prisoner of conscience and faced inhumane conditions and threats to his health during imprisonment. Upon his release, Amnesty International Senior Director for Research, Advocacy, Policy, and Campaigns, Erica Guevara Rosas, stated his pardons end as a grave injustice and is a testament to the tireless efforts of his families and lawyer, including his courageous mother, Leila Soif, an activist all over the world. Alaa Abdel Fattah was targeted for his peaceful activism. Finally, in the headlines, news research from the National Center for Immunization Research and Surveillance has found that the strategic development of nurses is central to improving vaccination rates in Australia. Childhood vaccination rates have been on the decline since 2020. The NCIRS suggests that funding and capacity for nurse-led immunization clinics need to be increased to improve access to vaccination. Specifically, the report called for rotating locations of clinics, extended hours, drop-in appointments, and on-site child and family health support. These recommendations came from recent findings from the National Vaccination Insights Project survey identifying barriers among parents and partially vaccinated kids. These included one quarter having difficulty in getting vaccination appointments when due, another quarter not prioritizing vaccination over other activities, and a fifth of parents unable to avoid costs, among other issues. These have been the news headlines for Tuesday, 30th of September, 2025. You're listening to 3CR Breakfast on 855 AM.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Want to become a socially progressive podcaster but don't know where to start?
3CR has a wealth of podcasting knowledge and experience, and we've developed a practical podcast training course to help community voices get into the world of podcasting.
Our two-day in-station course is perfect for new podcasters or people who want to improve their skills and get some insider tips.
Enroll now for our October podcast course.
Full details at 3cr.org.au/podcast services.
Or call the station during business hours on 03 9419 8377.
Enroll now for our October podcast course.
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast on 855 AM, 3CR Digital and 3cr.org.au. September 28 was International Safe Abortion Day, and in light of this day, we're going to start today's program by revisiting a conversation that we had with Dr. Susie Allinson and Lizzie O'Shea back on Tuesday Breakfast on 12th of July 2022 about the fight for reproductive rights in so-called Australia. Dr. Susie Allinson was a clinical psychologist for more than 35 years. 26 of those were at the Fertility Control Clinic in Melbourne. Susie led the clinic's campaign for safe access to abortion. And Lizzie O'Shea is a lawyer and writer. Lizzie represented the Fertility Control Clinic in the Supreme Court case to stop the harassment of staff and patients by anti-abortion fanatics. And together they wrote the book Empowering Women, From Murder and Misogyny to High Court Victory. Please note that since the airing of this conversation, WA has decriminalised abortion as of the 27th of March 2024. In the following conversation, Dr. Susie Allinson begins by speaking about their book, and then Lizzie O'Shea speaks about the overturning of Roe v. Wade and provides more insight into the Australian context. Here's Susie speaking about the book.
Look, it was released to mark the 20th anniversary of the murder of Fertility Control Clinic security guard, Steve Rogers. And that murder of a man by an anti-abortion religious fanatic triggered a fight for women's rights that ended up becoming a landmark High Court case for women. In contrast to what's going on in the States, the court unambiguously decided in women's favour, recognising that a woman's decision about a pregnancy is essential to who she is and how she lives her life, and that religious extremists must not block, shame or harangue her. And healthcare staff are not to be abused either. So from our case that was fought by an army of women and, Supreme Court case was pivotal in us winning in the court of public opinion and getting legislation that now sees abortion safe access zones of 150 metres now in place around Australia. And also every state now has decriminalised abortion.
Yeah, that's an incredible victory that you've just told us about, Susie. And we will get to each state's rules and regulations on abortion in just a moment. Lizzie, I just wanted to ask you, what are the big differences between laws on abortions in the US and in Australia? I feel like there has been a lot of discussion on Roe v. Wade recently, of course, since it was overturned in the US. And I think it's helpful just to remind listeners on what that looks like in an Australian context.
So Roe v. Wade was really a dialogue about the rights of states to impose conditions or impositions on women seeking abortions and whether that was legitimate constitutionally. And obviously the Supreme Court in the US is a federal body and states make laws themselves about certain matters. And essentially what Roe v. Wade did was endorse the right to an abortion on the grounds of privacy, saying that states couldn't impose certain kinds of obligations or impositions on women in order to access abortion care. But of course, since that time, we've seen states in the United States, including most notoriously perhaps Texas, but lots of different states across the entirety of the United States of America, introducing impositions and testing them constitutionally through the Supreme Court. And ultimately, this particular case that overturned Roe did succeed in doing so, essentially reversing the Supreme Court's ruling that states couldn't prohibit abortions in certain circumstances and couldn't impose certain kinds of obligations, which made it very difficult to access abortion. The reason I'm giving that kind of semi-technical background is I think it's fair to say that for a long time, access to abortion in the United States has been very difficult for many women across the entirety of the country, and particularly in states, obviously, where there's anti-choice legislators and senators and governors who do not support women's right to choose. But that has been a looming kind of reality for many millions of women in the United States, and that this recent overturning of Roe is probably the end point of that process that began decades previously. The difference is, of course, in Australia that we have states that did legislate for these kinds of things. You know, abortion was in the criminal code in places like Victoria, but largely across the country. But in the last 20 years, we've seen that being dismantled. So decriminalisation of abortion, you know, Western Australia is outstanding, but there's still a significant number, or, you know, abortion has largely been decriminalised in Western Australia. In each of the other states across the country, we've seen decriminalisation and then endorsement at the high court level of the capacity to bring laws that prohibit harassment of women around abortion clinics. So it's a bottom-up approach to the reform of the law that's sort of in reverse, or the reverse of what's occurred in Roe v. Wade, which I think is an interesting kind of example to look at. I mean, there's lots you could talk about in this respect, but one of the things I would say in summary is that in Australia, we've seen a movement of women, of advocates, people like Susie, lawyers like me, but many, many others who have been agitating for reform at a state-based level, and then proactive reform that's been endorsed as compatible with our constitution. And that has meant that the right to access abortion in legal terms is better protected than it is in the states. There are still access problems, no doubt, in Australia, but from a legal standpoint, we're in a much better position than our sisters in the US.
What are some of the non-legal access issues or obstacles that women and pregnant people face here in Australia?
Yeah, I'm happy to have a crack at answering that, although Susie probably knows firsthand as someone who's worked in a provider for a long time. I'm just a lawyer. But what I would say is that there are certainly parts of Australia, particularly if you're not in a city, where it can be difficult to access abortions. You know, there was a period in Tasmania, for example, where there was no one providing abortions in a specific clinic. But there are still methods of accessing abortion. Of course, you know, not all abortions occur in abortion clinics. So, you know, if you do have a miscarriage or an ectopic pregnancy where you still may need surgical intervention, obviously that can be available at hospitals and the like. So it's not but that's not the only kind of abortion that women seek either, of course. So, you know, a big part of abortion is being able to access it on demand and have the care available if you've got a problem pregnancy or a pregnancy that you need counselling for, that you're able to access those kinds of services for really easily. And that is much more difficult if you're not in a city particularly. Maybe also if you're from a specific cultural background and there may not be people who can assist you that can bridge that cultural divide and help you work through those issues. Those kinds of things are really important. I mean, in some ways, abortions are more accessible than ever. You know, we've got developments now with the availability of abortion drugs, so you don't need to have a surgical abortion. In many instances, you can have an abortion taking pills. However, it is really important that that process is under the supervision of a medical practitioner. And so I do think it is really important that you've got access to people who can help you through that process and explain it really clearly what's involved. And so I wouldn't want people to assume that the availability of those drugs has just solved all our access problems. I still think there's a real importance in developing practitioners and encouraging people within the medical profession to assist with these field and to help within make these decisions, but also then ensure that the care that they receive if they are proceeding with a termination is really of a high standard. And then, of course, if anything goes wrong with any of these procedures, that there's accessible treatment that's not far from people's homes, but doesn't require that, you know, you travel extensive distances and take time off work and, you know, find people to care for your children in order to be able to access an abortion. So
there's lots of different components of that kind of care. It's not even just the immediate front-facing care, but also some of the cultural and psychological components of seeking this treatment that are required to, you know, to fully understand access, I suppose, is what I would say. And it can be a slightly more complex issue than people think. But it is astonishing how few people are dedicated providers of abortion services across the country, and I think people would be surprised that it can be more difficult than it ought to be in a country where it's decriminalised and largely enshrined in law everywhere that access ought to exist legally. It is quite a different question in practical terms what that looks like.
Yeah, and just before we finish today, Susie, just touching on what Lizzie just said, in the book you were talking about your time at the Fertility Control Centre and talking about the fact that it was women-centred and so every aspect of women's health was being looked after and cared for. Can you just tell us, just to close our interview for today, tell us a bit about that and why we should have more of these centres that really prioritise every aspect of women's health?
Well, we had everything under one roof. So we had pathology and theatre and consulting rooms, and we had every health professional you could imagine, including pregnancy counsellors. So we were able to really provide a woman-centred approach, and our language and our whole approach was very woman-centred. But if I can just follow up on some of what Lizzie said, you know, there's no real medical pathway for training doctors in abortion, so that more GPs might take it on, or as Lizzie's pointed out, there just aren't enough services. Plus, our public hospitals really aren't, I don't think they're not really shouldering their responsibilities. And certainly, the government funded Catholic public hospitals, if you like, are not providing abortion services and various contraception services at all. Which, if they're receiving public funds, I just think that's pretty outrageous. So they're major issues. For those coming to a private hospital, as the fertility control clinic is, the Medicare rebate has not gone up for decades, I think, so that women are stuck with more out-of-pocket expenses there. So, you know, there's quite a bit there in terms of where we can definitely improve availability, accessibility, and affordability for women.
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast, and we were just listening to a conversation that I had with Dr. Susie Allinson and Lizzie O'Shea back in 2022 about their book Empowering Women from Murder and Misogyny to High Court Victory, about the context surrounding the overturning of Roe v. Wade in the United States and the ongoing barriers that pregnant people face when accessing abortions in this country. You're listening to 3CR Community Radio on 855 AM, and we're now going to go to a song. So this is by Georgia Mack, who was once a member of Camp Cope and is now releasing music as a solo artist. This next song is from her latest EP called God's Favourite, which was released earlier this month, and the song is called Pay Per View.
One friend, and we both want the same thing. Go out at night and come back in the morning. The walk of pride when I get inside. I can't say where I've been. I'm gonna find love again. I've got one phone, it's blowing up in my hand. Asking for blow or asking me how I am. Are this fine? And I don't mind. Where you are is where I've been. I'm gonna find love again. So I keep waiting on God's favorite pay-per-view to watch.
You
The Anti-Palestinian Racism in Schools report, which was launched last Friday, bringing together 15 months of testimonies from students, teachers, and school community members, revealed how anti-Palestinian racism is deployed and normalized in schools. We are joined today by Dr. Sophie Rudolph, one of the authors of the report. Dr. Sophie is a senior research fellow in the Faculty of Education at the University of Melbourne. She researches the educational implications of settler colonialism and is engaged with a range of communities in efforts towards transforming systems of oppression. Good morning, Sophie, and welcome to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's good to hear from you. How are you this morning?
I'm good, thank you.
So, yeah, it just launched on Friday, and there's obviously been a lot of news coverage about it since then. But could you just tell us a bit more about the report and why was this research undertaken?
Yeah, so the report came about through a community call to document experiences of anti-Palestinian racism that were occurring in schools. And this was something that the community felt was quite widespread and that there was very little recognition of or understanding of. And so they asked the Australian Palestine Advocacy Network to set up a register to record these experiences. And then APAN asked Randa Abdel Fattah to assemble a group of academics with expertise in sociology and education and anti-racism to analyse these reports to the register and try and understand these experiences in the context of education and the social and political kind of environment. That team is Ryan Al-Natour, Randa, and Tasneem Samak, and myself.
Incredible, yeah. And obviously it was an incredibly rich research, as the key findings were showing. But yeah, perhaps you could share with our audience what were some of the key findings of the report, and perhaps as well anything that was particularly significant or shocking to you.
Sure, yeah. So we analysed the key findings under six sections. We found that experiences of anti-Palestinian racism that were submitted to the register demonstrated repression through silencing and censorship and through calls for neutrality and objectivity in schools. And so this was experienced by teachers being told that they couldn't mention Palestine or discuss it with their students or in class. Students were also prevented from choosing Palestine as a topic to study or using the colours of the Palestinian flag in their work. And there was really a widespread experience of silencing and censorship. It also, racism occurred through penalising and disciplining. So students who were wearing a kafir or carrying a Palestinian flag, even on a multicultural day, were told that they had to put that away or it was actually confiscated. We heard about teachers who were sent home for distributing leaflets amongst their in the staff room about events to support Palestine and what's happening to the Palestinians. We also found that there were breaches of policy.
Okay.
In particular, in New South Wales, there's a policy called controversial issues in schools.
Yeah.
And this is to try and help teachers to address and engage with what are considered controversial issues.
Yeah.
In the classroom. And we found that instead of encouraging teachers and helping teachers to engage with that in relation to Palestine, they were shut down.
Wow.
So there was a, you know, that obviously schooling spaces were struggling to engage with this issue, and were putting in place these quite harsh policies around silencing and censorship.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I remember at the launch, you know, that student mentioned how, you know, he felt unsafe wearing his own cultural, you know, attire. And there was like a primary school student who was told off for having a watermelon badge by a teacher, which sounds insane to me because it's a badge. But
Right.
Particularly interesting, I guess, for you, for me, is like because you're an education researcher who focuses on the implications of education within and against Australian settler colonialism. And what are some of the threats, I guess, that you notice between Indigenous injustices and anti-Palestinian racism in schools?
Yeah, so I think what's interesting about this is that both Australia and Israel are settler colonial states.
Yeah.
And so settler colonialism is a system that's based on racial domination, and what Indigenous Australian theorist Aileen Morton Robinson has called white possession.
Yeah.
And so to maintain this system of white possession, the state dehumanises and maintains its racial domination. And this occurs through the systems and the practices of the settler colonial state. So obviously at its very worst, and what we see occurring in Palestine at the moment is genocide. But then we can see this happening through other things in Australia as well, actually, that are shared both in Australia and in Israel. So black deaths in custody, health inequalities, youth in imprisonment, these sort of disproportionate impacts on First Nations communities and
Absolutely.
Palestinians
yeah.
In Israel. So these seek to destroy, harm and injure Indigenous people.
Yeah.
And so we can see that this occurrence of anti-Palestinian racism in Australian schools is a symptom of a settler colonial state that that is about protecting white dominance and siding with that in the context of the violence that Israel is perpetrating on the Palestinian people. And the state seeks to kind of protect this white dominance, and in doing that, there is backlash towards anyone who is considered a threat to that white dominance. And so we, the authors, thought that it was really important to understand these experiences of racism as difficult and challenging as they are in the context of that broader settler colonial system.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's like incredibly powerful, obviously, in Indigenous the push for truth telling, you know, among Indigenous peoples is basically the same thing that this report has essentially done, right? It's this laying it out bare, the absolutely shocking racism that we do see in our schools as a result of long-standing settler colonialism here in Australia itself, which I think essentially paved the way for that kind of anti-Palestinian racism that we now see. I guess to wrap us up on a more positive note, the testimonies from the students, the teachers, very much reveal how insidious and harmful anti-Palestinian racism is. But I feel like the very existence of the report speaks to an insistence to possibilities and transformation. At the launch, Dr. Ryan Al-Natur specifically quoted bell hooks that the classroom remains the most radical space of possibility, which I thought was beautiful. What then to you, I guess, are the possibilities that could emerge from this report, do you think?
Yeah, and bell hooks is a really inspiring educator around thinking about possibility and transforming systems of oppression. So she's a wonderful one to think with in this regard. And I think, as you mentioned before, this report is an act of truth-telling. Samara Hand, who was also on the launch panel, who is a First Nations scholar based in New South Wales, talked about the importance of truth-telling. And I think that this is a commitment not to maintain the denial and not to continue these harmful forms of silencing and censorship. But Samara also talked about the need to move beyond that into spaces of healing and justice. So I think, you know, the classroom, as bell hooks has told us, can be a place of critical pedagogies. Yes. And these are when students learn about power and oppression and how to transform these systems into places of collective care and justice. And that does involve facing the truth and looking at that systemically, thinking about the ways that our systems are set up to produce these harms, and then working together in solidarity between students and teachers to look at how those systems can be transformed. So I think there's great possibility.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and I think that was what was incredible at the launch as well, having a teacher and student there to show that it wasn't, you know, just teacher towards student or student towards teacher, but this is something that impacts every level of community in the school. So, yeah. Thank you so much, Dr. Sue. I wish we had more time to chat, but that's all the time we have for now. But thank you for joining us. And, yeah, looking forward to chatting with you again in future.
Sounds good. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Been listening to Dr. Sophie Rudolph speaking to us about the Anti-Palestinian Racism in Schools report, which was launched last Friday.
Up next, we're going to be playing a song. This song is a new release from Stella Donnelly entitled Feel It Change.
Time.
You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast on 3CR Community Radio, and we just played Feel It Change by Stella Donnelly. We are now joined on the phone by Bea, who leads the Asian Migrant Project at Vixen. They do outreach and support work and advocate for sex workers. They are also one of the co-founders of Justice for Our Sisters, a collective of Asian and Asian migrant sex workers in Nam. And last time we had Bea on the show, we spoke about the ongoing raids by Australian Border Force that are targeting Asian migrant sex workers, as well as Vixen's new project called Rising Red Lantern, and what is required to achieve full decriminalisation of sex work in so-called Victoria. Bea joined us on the show again this morning to give us an update on the violence and threats made to Asian migrant sex workers and the upcoming fundraising event for Rising Red Lantern. And just before we begin our discussion, listeners are advised that the following conversation might include descriptions of police raids and references to violence against sex workers. If you are a migrant sex worker in need of support, you can reach out to your local peer organisation, that's Scarlet Alliance for the Peak Body at scarletalliance.org.au, or Vixen in so-called Australia at vixen.org.au. And if you need to talk to someone about the issues covered in today's discussion, you can contact QLife on 1800 184 527. Thanks for joining us back on the show again, Bea.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Bea, as I said in my introduction, last time we had you on the show, we spoke about the raids that have been taking place across brothels in so-called Nam. Can you give us an update on that situation? Have we been seeing even more raids happening at brothels and other places in the city?
Yes, unfortunately. Even last night, I just went on outreach because of the raid. It's happened, you know, within these last couple of weeks. Yeah, we've seen increasing since the around end of financial year, and it's increasing, happening like at least once a week since August. We've seen the tactics from the Border Force that now it's shifted to training brothel owners or managers of how to police workers through the check on the government system. And now sort of train them to kind of be the immigration officers. Plus the raiding still happening with the workers, like going through the, when in the changing room, when the workers still undresses.
Yeah, so what you've just described, you know, it sounds like now workers can't even be safe at their own workplace because there might be managers or owners who might dob them in or use, you know, their visa status or hold it against them. Do we know the reason for the increase in these raids?
For me, I personally believe that is, you know, come through the social, come through the what happened in the US with the ICE, comes from the, you know, even anti-immigration rally that just happened. Mm-hmm. I think those stuff is kind of, you know, trigger those right wing, those anti-immigration that are already out there, and how the government's use this against to marginalized communities, especially Asian migrant sex workers.
Yeah, and, you know, Asian migrant sex workers are some of the most vulnerable workers. We said last time, you know, there's like a lack of safety and security for them as workers. That doesn't surprise me that they are being targeted in this way. Can you talk about the powers that Australian Border Force have and what rights workers have if there is a raid? I know that on the Vixen website, you know, there's information about what workers can say yes or no to if a raid does occur. So I was wondering if you could talk a bit about that.
Yeah, definitely. I think the most important thing that people aren't aware of is Border Force can enter the workplace if they have a warrant or if someone consent them to come in. For example,
they usually use a tactic that kind of like try to ask the workers, like, can I come in? And most of us might just say yes. So that it means you already consent them to come in. But actually, you have every right to say no and ask them really calmly, like, do you have a warrant? And if they don't, you can ask them to get one and come back later.
I think that's really important to share with workers because, like you said, you know, I think a lot of people would just say yes without actually knowing what their rights are and what the consequences of saying yes would have on their safety. So that's really important to know. Thanks for that, Bea. Last time you were on the show, you spoke to us about Rising Red Lantern, which is a new project by Vixen. And I know that there's a fundraiser coming up in a couple of weeks. So can you tell us more about that? What are you raising money for? And what can listeners expect at this event?
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much. So the Rising Red Lanterns fundraisers will be on the Friday of 10th October at Vixen office, which around Brunswick area. We will be raising the money because of this ongoing raid and also like ongoing violence from the society and from the client that still out there. And because of the state neglect funding cut, so these all will be supporting our community, especially Asian migrant sex worker, to have resources and ongoing and sustainable through the outreach workers as well. Mm-hmm. There will be performance through our Asian sex worker performing out there, and I think there will be selling food and we kind of center of Asian community, not just only sex worker. So everyone able to draw, everyone able to like come in. And also we have the Red Lantern section making, banner making. So these are the activities. Red Lantern and also banners will be demonstrated at the front of the court of Hugo on the end of the October as well. So really keen to see everyone out there.
Yeah, thanks so much for that. And we'll include all the details in our show notes after today's program. My final question for you, Bea, this morning is to talk about the court hearing for Yuko. Can you remind our listeners who Yuko was and why it's important to support Asian migrant sex workers, especially ahead of the 31st of October?
Yeah, Yuko was an incredible sex worker in our community. If you are in the trans community, she's really well known in the trans community because she's also a worker and she's also an kind of owner in her little space. And she's the one that, you know, taking all the trans worker working with her, even like someone doesn't have the home or using drugs as well. And her court case will be moved to contested committal hearing on the 31st October. Is it open for the public? So everyone, you know, that would like to join to listen to the court case, it starts around in the morning. And we will be bring all the Red Lanterns. We need hundreds of Red Lanterns on that day. We need the people to come and help for the banners on that day. That's why in the fundraising event, we'll be making that. And we hope, like, after that, we'll be open for everyone to come in and help to make these hundreds of Red Lanterns together. This will be a really strong kind of visually demonstrate outside to show that how community support this kid and to show that we still watching this case together.
Yeah, I think that's going to be such a beautiful display of love and care for Yuko, but also for other Asian migrant sex workers who have been murdered in the past, but who also face violence daily, whether that's from clients or from state violence from the police and Australian Border Force. So, and like you said, to tell everyone that we're still following these stories, that we haven't forgotten, and that whether, you know, we're sex workers or allies, that we stand in solidarity with community. Thank you so much, Bea, for joining us on the show again today to speak to us about the ongoing raids. I think it's really important that you made that comparison with what's happening in the US, and, you know, we know that people are really caring and really worried about the ICE raids that are happening across the states. But it's important to know that that sort of violence is happening here in so-called Australia. So thanks again, Bea, for joining us on the show this morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
We've been speaking to Bea from Vixen and Justice for Our Sisters. To find more about the upcoming fundraising event to raise money for Red Rising Lantern, which is supporting Asian migrant sex workers in so-called Victoria, please go to vixen.org.au. You can also listen back to last night's episode of Satellite Skies on 3CR as Bea joined Race Rage to speak more about the work that they do. We are going to be back with our discussion with Penny Carr right after these messages.
Do you work in a brothel, massage shop, escort agency, fetish house or dungeon, cam studio or porn set, sauna, short-time hotel, outdoors or on the street, or in any other space where sex work happens? Recent changes to Victorian sex work laws mean that sex workers now have more options for how and where we can work and who we can work with.
To find out more about Victoria's new sex work laws, contact Vixen, Victoria's statewide peer-only sex work organisation, 100% by and for all sex workers on 039-070-9050.
And talk to another sex worker about what the partial decriminalisation of sex work means for you, your workplace and your community. Or check out the Decrim Info Hub at vixen.org.au. Vixen is a 3CR supporter.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalization intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo-poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
Staff liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo!
Hi, my name is Miss Kinnan. I'm a proud Yoruba, Jajarong, Kalkadoon and Yirrindali Aboriginal Sovereign Woman. And you're listening to 3CR, guys. Check in with your friends. Make sure you guys are going good. And also stick up for what's right, yeah? Free Palestine.
You're listening to 3CR Tuesday Breakfast, and up next we're chatting to Penny Carr, who's the convener of the National Association of Renters Organisations, and which is the NRAO, which is a federation of state and territory-based tenants' unions and tenants' advice services across Australia. And this month, the National Association of Renters Organisations has released a national report card into renting 2 years on from when the National Cabinet promised a better deal for renters. And Penny is here to chat to us about the findings of that report card and what issues remain for renters and what we actually need from government to create a much fairer deal for renters. But welcome to 3CR, Penny.
Good morning.
Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning, Penny. Can you give us a bit of context? Who is the National Association of Renters Organisations as a peak body? What does the organisation do?
Yeah, so effectively it's a group of organisations, one generally from each jurisdiction, state or territory around our country, that works within their jurisdiction. For example, I'm the CEO of Tenants Queensland. I work within Queensland. So we're all working with renters in our state or territory, and we come together in a fairly loose collective, really. Currently, we have never had any funding or anything, but we try to coordinate our work and coordinate our understandings and of the situation for renters and what renters need. And we've, over the last couple of years, done this report card following the National Cabinet Better Deal for Renters to see how we were tracking along those proposed reforms that the National Cabinet proposed.
Yeah, definitely. And can you tell us a bit more, Penny, about what that better deal for renters that was promised was? Like what was actually outlined from the National Cabinet?
Yeah, so National Cabinet made an announcement that they wanted to see some nationally consistent policy across the country, and they outlined a few areas which they thought, which they included in that consistent framework. The first one was making sure there was a genuine reasonable ground for any eviction. There were things around making fairer appeals for against retaliatory evictions fairer, looking toward only having one rent increase per year. There was a mixed practices across the country at the time. Implementing a ban on soliciting rent bidding, so when you're going for a property, someone asking you to bid more so you'll have a better chance. Some changes around domestic and family violence and renters when they experience that, about how they can end agreements and change locks, and a couple of other things in that space. Limiting how much a break lease might cost you. So there was, so you could have a limited liability if you had to end a tenancy agreement early. Making rental applications easier and helping to protect renters' personal information, whether they did get the tenancy or they didn't get the tenancy, because anyone who is a renter knows they're giving an enormous amount of information all the time to secure a property at the moment.
Yeah.
And there was some things around better regulation of short-stay rental accommodation, such as Airbnb, et cetera. And the last one was to raise or include some minimum quality standards for rental accommodation, although what they gave as an example wasn't particularly aspirational. They gave the examples of stovetops in good working order and hot and cold running water. So there was 9 areas that they outlined for improvements and for national kind of consistency.
Yeah, definitely. I think all of those things are so important, and some of those as well wouldn't be things that you necessarily would always think of, particularly maybe people who aren't renting wouldn't be aware of a lot of those, particularly a lot of the information that's being required to be given over. With the national report card, can you tell us a bit about the main findings from that report card?
Yeah, so at a very high level, and we're looking 2 years on now, this is the second year post the Better Deal for Renters, we can see that most jurisdictions, most states and territories have done something, but some have done much more than others, and probably no jurisdiction has really completed the reforms and made it easier for renters to actually utilise them. I guess the standout would probably is definitely Victoria. Victoria have made a lot of positive reforms. There's still some things that they might need to do to make it a completely a fairer system for renters, but they've certainly gone through the list of reforms, and if they haven't completed them yet, they are on their way. So they're the really sort of leading light, but they would themselves say there's still more to do because not everybody has been captured by those reforms either. So there's some people who are on tenancy agreements that started before a certain date who won't actually benefit from some of the reforms. I suppose there's also some jurisdictions, though, that have taken very few actions and you know, really are dragging the chain. And you'd probably have to highlight WA and Northern Territory in that way. And I just want to say these are reforms that every state and territory agreed with the Commonwealth to do. So there's not really any reason that they shouldn't be cracking on and getting it done.
Yeah, definitely. It sounds like, you know, it was a nationally agreed upon deal, and, yeah, it would only make sense that all of the states would be, you know, doing their part to bring upon those reforms. But could you speak a little bit more about, you've mentioned WA and the NT are really lagging on improving rental rights. Could you give a few examples of, you know, what are some of the rights that are lacking in those areas?
Yeah, well, certainly both of them have done have made no improvements on one of the really important reforms, which is to prevent tenants being evicted without any reason. So generally, and this used to happen across the country, at the end of a fixed-term agreement or any time during a month-to-month agreement, someone could get a notice to leave if it had the right notice period on it. It didn't have to have a reason. And this has been one of the reforms through the Better Deal for Renters. Not all states have embraced it fully, but definitely WA and NT have taken no steps to make any changes. Other states, New South Wales, the ACT, Victoria and South Australia, if you live in those states and someone wants to end your tenancy, they have to have a good reason in law to end the tenancy. So, for example, when the tenant's not in breach, there has to be a reason, something like the owner or their immediate family want to move in, the property's going to be removed from the market to be because there's a change of use or it needs significant repair or renovation. So when the tenant's, there's no breach by the tenant, there has to be a reason in law, whereas in even in Queensland and Tasmania, they have some protections under some fixed-term periodic agreements, but if you're on a fixed-term tenancy, at the end of that tenancy, it can be ended simply because the fixed term is coming to an end, which means everyone's pushed onto a fixed-term tenancy and many tenancies end without grounds.
Mm. And you touched on it a bit earlier, Penny. Would you be able to elaborate on some of the key concerns in relation to people facing domestic violence, maybe in relation to breaking leases or privacy concerns?
So most states have done relatively well in this regard. They have made some changes. In the Better Deal, the changes were about ending agreements without penalty. So if you're a victim survivor and you need to leave the tenancy, so ending agreements without penalty and with a more streamlined process, so maybe a broader variety of people who can give evidence that you're in that situation and not just a court order, a violence, a DVO or something. The ability to change locks and make security improvements without the lessor or the landlord's permission prior. And having a person's name removed from a tenancy database, if there was damage that wasn't their fault, but it was caused by a situation of domestic and family violence where they were the victim survivor. And also looking at where that didn't already apply, the ability for victim survivors to have the perpetrator of the violence removed from the property and the tenancy changed to their name. So they were the proposals that that cabinet put, and most states and territories have actually done the majority of that work. And I suppose it's because domestic and family violence is such a high priority in all of our communities in trying to address those horrendous situations that we've been seeing.
Definitely, and I think that's such an important step forward. And really helpful for people that they, you know, no longer have all these barriers to leaving really difficult situations. Would you be able to speak, Penny, a bit about what some of the suggestions or demands on the government would be moving forward based on the national report card that came out?
Yeah, so I suppose first and foremost, we want the government to have some sort of review and enforcement mechanism so we can look at the agreements that were made and put some pressure on those states and territories who aren't stepping up to the plate. So first and foremost, we want to see what's been agreed, driven home by the federal government. And we think that they've got a few levers and ways in which they could do that. And I think we could do a lot more work to make sure that the changes between the jurisdictions are also effective and consistent. So, for example, with those ending of tenancies, the reasonable grounds, some states have got some that have got poles you could drive through them, and others are much tighter. So it'd be good to see, even at the next layer down, the more detailed layer down, that we are getting consistency in our tenancy laws. But I think that there's still work to be done. We want to push the government, the federal government, to find ways to work with the states and territories to make sure these are all driven home, these current Better Deal for Renter agreements are driven home. But we do want to see them go further. Really, when you're a renter, what would the ideal would be that you could rent a home or you could own a home and you have 10-year equity. You have the same or at least similar sense of security and the quality of the product, the safety of the product that you have if you're an owner-occupier or a renter. And we've got some things to do before we get to that point. The security issue is where we aren't pushed out of our homes unless there's a good reason. That's already in the current Better Deal. But the minimum standards currently in this Better Deal do not include any energy efficiency, and we need to make sure renters are brought along on this journey to on our transition to net zero, and you know, they're able to also benefit from reduced energy costs through that transition. Because at the moment, renters are generally living in very hot or very cold properties, and they have very little ability to impact on that energy efficiency standard within the property. But the other thing, the other big issue for people is affordability. So what the first Better Deal round of proposals did was to say that there should only be one rent increase every year, and that's a good start, but it's really not going to drive affordability for renters. We really do need to see that there are some caps on the amounts rent can go up when a person's already living in a property. So we might see a market rent to enter, but when you're living in that property, capping rent increases once a year to the CPI, which is what is currently happening in the ACT, would give predictability both to landlords and to renters about what they're going to have to, work into their budget for the next 12 months. Without that, without limiting how much rent can go up, any sort of change around how often it can go up is really ineffective.
Yeah, I think that's so important. And I know personally from renting in the ACT and then moving to Victoria, I was kind of shocked that that wasn't the case, that the landlords here could just increase rent however much they liked. But I think that really illustrates, you know, just how much there is inconsistency across the states and how we need a lot more consistency across the board. And before we wrap up, Penny, is there anywhere that our 3CR listeners can go if they want to find out more about the report or access any support as a renter?
Yes. So the report that we've just released is called the Rental Report, a performance on the progress of Better Deal for Renters. If you just look up the rental report, you will come across it, and I'll make sure it's up on our Tenants Queensland website this afternoon. I'm fairly confident it's up on Tenants Union New South Wales site. But if you're a renter looking for advice, you need to find the tenancy association or union in your state or territory. So in many places it's Tenants Union, Tenants Queensland, Tenants Victoria, the Northern Territory, the Darwin Community Legal Centre runs their tenancy service, mm-hmm. Circle Green and WA. But it tenancy advice and put your state or territory in, and I'm pretty sure you'll come up.
Yeah.
With,
yeah. Yeah, fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Penny, for joining us on Tuesday Breakfast this morning. We really appreciate all these insights into, yeah, the very complicated world of renting.
No worries, and good luck with everyone out there who's renting.
Thank you so much. You too. Well, we've been speaking to Penny Carr from the National Association of Renters Organisations about the recent national report card into renting 2 years on from the Better Deal for Renters.
Subscribe to 3CR. Where else can you hear radical news, analysis, music and opinions? Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 03 9419 8377.
Thank you, 3CR. We love you.
You're listening to Tuesday Breakfast on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM. And to conclude today's program, we're joined once again by Lucinda Thorpe, who is privacy campaigner at Digital Rights Watch. Lucinda is back on the program to talk about the Privacy Commissioner's recent landmark decision regarding Kmart's use of facial recognition technology and the impacts that this technology continues to have on our privacy. Welcome back to Tuesday Breakfast, Lucinda.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom.
I was wondering if you could start by giving our listeners a summary of Kmart's use of facial recognition technology and the Privacy Commissioner's landmark determination that I just mentioned.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Privacy Commissioner has ruled that Kmart's use of facial surveillance technology to scan every individual entering certain stores breached privacy law. Now, this was happening in all states and territories apart from the NT and Tasmania. Now, importantly, Kmart did not obtain consent to collect sensitive biometric data, as they're actually required to do under the Privacy Act. And the exact number of people affected is still unknown, but estimates extend to the hundreds of thousands. Now, Kmart argued that its use of facial surveillance fell within an exemption to the Privacy Act, which permits data collection to combat unlawful activity. Specifically, Kmart actually wanted to combat refund fraud, so not even just like broader shoplifting, but specifically refund fraud. But the commissioner found that the technology was only partially suitable for that purpose, and given how invasive it is to have a scan of your face taken and then put into an unknown system, it was found to be completely disproportionate, especially given that the amount of refund fraud prevented was actually quite small. The exact number has been redacted from the report, but given that it was only found to be partially suitable, it couldn't have been much.
Yeah, that is pretty scary stuff to know that a corporation as big as Kmart can be doing this and not even show how much impact this had for their refund fraud that they purportedly were using this technology for. And I guess it is a welcome decision from the Privacy Commissioner who found that that was unlawful. I was wondering if you could speak a bit more broadly about how businesses are using this facial surveillance technology. And you said just before that they are supposed to obtain consent when doing this. So how does that work?
Yeah, absolutely. So facial surveillance technology is becoming increasingly more common, and how businesses use it varies. So firstly, it's different to the idea that you used to like unlock your phone. That's quite a benign use because you're consenting to that and you are the one setting it up. However, facial surveillance, you typically don't even know that it is happening to you because it's you don't have signs out the front of public places or businesses saying that, you know, your face is going to be getting scanned. And what informed consent could look like for that is still kind of up for debate. I mean, you could maybe have a sign out the front saying, by the way, we're scanning your face, and that would be a better example of transparency. So right now, yep, the technology is becoming increasingly popular. We saw Bunnings had a decision made by the Privacy Commissioner late last year that its use was also illegal. And the way this software is working is it basically scans your face either from CCTV, can sometimes be body cam footage, or even from like a self-checkout, and it then maps the different points on your face and compares it to a database of other biometric templates searching for a match. So it could be a match on, for Bunnings, it was known aggressive customers. In a law enforcement context, it can be for known people with like a criminal record. Now, in the Bunnings decision, their use of facial surveillance was for aggressive customers, and once again, it was found to be completely disproportionate because of just how invasive the technology is.
Yeah, and I guess continuing on from this point that you're making as well, when it comes to having like a database of people who are so-called, you know, known aggressors or aggressive mm-hmm. customers, things like that, how does this technology further discriminate against people who are already discriminated against, over-policed, over-surveilled, people from black and brown communities, people yeah. who have formerly been incarcerated and are continuing to be subject to surveillance? So how does this technology contribute to these factors?
Yep, great question. So firstly, there's a lot of bias in what is considered to be aggressive. And as we know that like people of colour are more, their actions are more likely to be interpreted as aggressive. And statistically, due to a lot of factors, they're also more likely to end up in people with criminal history databases. So they're more likely to be checked against as being a match. One example of this is in 2021, the New South Wales Police Force had an AI-driven surveillance system called Insight. The system analysed a broad range of data sources, including body cam footage, public CCTV, dash cam recordings, to identify patterns and potential suspects. The targeted locations of this surveillance were typically in over-policed, low socioeconomic areas, often moved into by new migrants, so they're really diverse. And therefore, the technology was being used disproportionately against people of colour. Now, the facial recognition technology that was being used by the police force was developed by Cognitech Systems and has been found to misidentify individuals of West African descent almost 7 times more than those of a European background. And this is one of the best products on the market to give you an idea of just how biased these systems are. So it means that people of West African descent, people of colour, are more likely to be matched up to about more than 7 times more likely to be matched. Now, this is very problematic. If it's being used in a loss prevention context at the retail store, it means they're more likely to be approached and be accused of being a shoplifter. They're more likely to be kind of in-person surveilled within the store. And this can act as a real barrier to just getting what you want from the store without being harassed. Yeah. And it has really serious consequences in a law enforcement environment as well. And for this reason, New South Wales did ultimately end up scrapping that facial recognition technology because it was that bad. So, Fong, you are 100% right to question the connection between facial surveillance and the criminalisation of people in colour.
I think that just...
People of colour, sorry.
Yeah. No, I think it just goes to show, you know, for anyone who thinks that technology is neutral or, you know, doesn't discriminate. I think that's so not true from what we've seen with AI, with, you know, language models, with things like this sort of surveillance technology. I mean, they are built by people with biases and exist in these communities where there is you know, systematic and state-sanctioned violence against black and brown communities. So there should be no surprise there. Before we wrap up, Lucinda, I was wondering if you could talk about just any regulations or safeguards out there against using this sort of facial surveillance technology.
Yeah, absolutely. So currently Australia has no regulatory or legal frameworks that govern facial recognition technologies. So this means that companies, governments and their staff can basically do whatever they want without legal oversight. Now, facial biometric data is classified as sensitive under the Privacy Act, so it's subject to extra protections. However, there are loopholes and quite broad exceptions which allow companies to step outside of its scope and essentially do as they please. So Digital Rights Watch is calling for a moratorium on the use of this technology until we have a privacy landscape which is up to scratch and can ensure that Australians' privacy is actually being prioritised throughout this process. Now, it's not a supplement for a dedicated framework to address facial surveillance, but privacy reforms like the right to delete will also help Australians gain agency over how scans of their face are used.
Well, thank you so much for that, Lucinda. And I think as we see more and more of this technology being normalised, it's so important to continue having these conversations around privacy. So once again, thanks for joining us on Tuesday Breakfast this morning to chat to us about this.
No worries. Thank you so much for having me.
We've been speaking to Lucinda Thorpe, Privacy Commissioner at Digital Rights Watch, about the use of facial recognition technology and the dangers of normalising this sort of surveillance tech. To learn more about your rights, head to digitalrightswatch.org.au. And I think we're going to go straight into the events calendar for this week, as we are very quickly running out of time. So just to let listeners know, last week we spoke to Toad from Permaqueer about their upcoming webinars about how permaculture is political. That is starting this Thursday, the 2nd of October. So to sign up, you can go to permaqueer.com. On Saturday, the 4th of October at 1 p.m. outside the Treasury Gardens, or at the Treasury Gardens, there'll be a rally to protect the Greater Glider. And this is being organised by a coalition of organisations, including the Wilderness Society, Victorian Forest Alliance and Friends of the Earth. And finally, as well, on October 4th at 2 p.m, there'll be an event called Politics in the Pub, Why Labour Supports Genocide in Gaza. And that is being held at Bojack Brewery, Brewing, on Bennett Street in Dandenong.
Yeah, it's been a very busy show today, and we might do a quick rundown of today's show as well.
Sure. So we started off the program by replaying a conversation we had with Dr. Susie Allinson and Lizzie O'Shea back in 2022 about the fight for reproductive rights in so-called Australia.
And at 7:30, we listened to Dr. Sophie Rudolph speaking about the Anti-Palestinian Racism in Schools report that was launched last Friday.
We were then joined at 7:45 by Bea from Vixen, who spoke about the ongoing raids by Australian Border Force targeting Asian migrant sex workers and the upcoming fundraising event for Rising Red Lantern.
And then at 8 a.m. we spoke to Penny Carr from the National Association of Renters Organisations about the recent national report card evaluating the better deal for renters proposed by the National Cabinet.
And finally, we were joined just on the phone now by Lucinda Thorpe from Digital Rights Watch, speaking to us about the dangers of businesses using facial recognition technology.
And it's been a really massive show today. You've been listening to Tuesday Breakfast on Tuesday, the 30th of September. And I want to say thank you to Fisa Fong and Elena for being in the studio with me today, and we look forward to having everyone join us next week for next week's show on 855 AM.
Standing Together for Public Housing is a campaign to stop the privatisation of public housing. Come to a public meeting at 6 p.m. on the 23rd of October at the Capitol Theatre to have your say on how to maintain and build more public housing instead of knocking it down. 6 p.m. Thursday, 23rd of October at the Capitol Theatre, 113 Swanson Street, Melbourne. For more details, see the Standing Together for Public Housing Facebook page. The Public Housing Campaign is a 3CR supporter.
This is Jazz Party and you're listening to...
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find NIBS opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.